morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me.
Mike Cosentino, and it's time for politics. Oh, wait a minute. No, it's not.
No.
No.
This is Democratic Perspective. How can we never talk about Democratic politics? What's going on, Mike?
Well, in a way we are. Sam Pillsbury, winemaker par excellence, and is a lefty from the old school, but that's a topic for another show. Paula Wosley is here this morning, and Sam Pillsbury, and they're going to give us the lowdown, the scoop, the inside story. This is Film Festival weekend in Sedona, so we're all full of lowdowns and inside stories and industry stuff, and so that's what we got here on the Verde Valley wine industry this morning. We have these two folks. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how are you, mate?
I'm good. Sam is talking to me again because I did not give him good directions coming to the studio.
I'm sure it was my GPS as well.
And Paula, good morning.
Morning, men. How are you?
Very good.
And we want to talk about the wine industry coming into the Verde Valley, and it's been coming for quite a few years. And from our point of view, it's the most interesting new industry coming into the Verde Valley, and one that's that synchronizes with tourism and all the other strengths of the Verde Valley. In fact, we have a beautiful river and so forth and so on. So where do we start, Mike? Who wants to?
It is kind of a perfect storm, having the wine and the tourism and the river and all of these things kind of coming together. The wine was just a perfect addition, and it's found
dry.
A home. And then, oh, yeah, by the way, the soil. And then we can talk about one of the things, for those people that are taking notes, we're going to talk about the training. You know, Yavapai College does kind of a unique thing, and Paul is involved with that.
Sam, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Because you don't just make wines, you also make movies, right?
It's funny, actually, that I'd forgotten that the Sedona Film Festival was on, because I had a feature film that I made in New Zealand that was in that festival. I think it was about 4 years ago. And, that's great to have something like that, and it's part of the cultural thing. I mean, it's funny, the synergies are wonderful. Because wine and movies seem to go together. Many of my filmmaker friends actually make wine. It's quite extraordinary, and people have often asked me why that is, and I'm not really sure. I mean, one way of looking at it is that we like to be kind of we like to be gods.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of creative.
Well,
right?
Yeah, and then the other thing is it's just it's a sensual thing. I mean, movies are actually, although they're synthetic, they're kind of sensual, and wine certainly is, and it's also a very challenging thing that you do to go out to the public and please people. So I'm not quite sure what the connection is, but there definitely is one.
But wine is in some ways the same way. The secret is it's a lot of fun.
I've never.
And it's also a challenge. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, I felt that way about movies, and it sure as heck is true of wine. I've never had so much fun in my life.
You know, I really love the growing part. I have to admit, I worked my way through college as an orchardist. So when it comes to fun, there was a fun part, but there was also this horrible slave to weather. I mean, your life was pretty much
it's farming.
It's farming. Yeah, there you go. That's the word I'm looking for.
You just gotta, right up until 3 days before we pick the last fruit, people are saying to me, How's it going? I said, don't say a word.
Jinx it.
Well, hail. I mean,
one hailstorm and you're dead, you know?
That's it.
You just gotta kind of, it keeps you in touch with the forces of nature, that's for sure.
Well, exactly. And tell us about your vineyard.
I have a vineyard quite a long, 300 miles from here, actually. My grapes are all grown in Cochise County, just south of Wilcox, in the foothills of the Chiricahua Mountains. And I planted my first grapevines down there 15 years ago when there was two little tiny vineyards nearby. And it turned out to be a good choice because now it's about 76% of Arizona wine grapes come from that area, and there's 500 acres of vines all around me. It's such a perfect place to grow wine for a whole bunch of reasons, which I could go into if you want. I now have 14,000 vines, and we're producing maybe 75 tons of fruit this year.
There's two things. The
name of the winery is?
Pillsbury Wine Company.
Yeah,
people come up to me and say, where did you get the name Pillsbury from? And I said, you know what? I had this really good idea. I think I'll call my wine after a flower company.
And Sam makes extraordinarily good wines and some interesting and strange ones. You made a dessert wine that was different than anything I'd ever tasted and very, very good.
It was a wonderful experiment. We grow a grape called Symphony, and there's only 200 acres of it in the world. It was a grape that was developed over 50 years by UC Davis, and it's a cross between Grenache Gris and Muscat of Alexandria. And the people who grow it usually make a sweeter wine for it. I'm a big fan of dry aromatics, so for the first couple of years I made a dry Symphony, which is intensely fruity but clean and fresh as well. And then we kind of edged into a slightly, you know, an off-dry that we call Goddess. That's and what I found, of all the white wines that I've worked with, it's the only white wine that almost seems to improve a little bit of sweetness. Mostly white wines dumb down the sweeter they get. There are some exceptions like that. Like there's some Gewürztraminer and Rieslings, which are good when they're sweet. They're also terrific dry. So then last year we did an experiment. We pulled a bunch of fruit and put it into some neutral oak barrels and just left it alone. So the wine fermented with the wild yeast that they came in. Now I'm a big proponent of local. I mean, all of my fruit comes from my vineyard or one of my two neighbors in Cochise County. I wanted to make a wine that stringently reflected the terroir, that particular place in that spot. So A, I could say it's completely original, and B, it really expressed that region. So when you bring in fruit and ferment it with wild yeast, rather than doing what's more conventional, which is that you stun the yeast that they come in with SO2, and then you add a cultured yeast, which has a pedigree, and you know exactly what it's going to do.
Explain wild yeast.
Okay. Everything's there. I mean, that's how wine was happened in the first place. Someone left some grape juice in a urn, you know, and it fermented and turned into wine. So there's yeast everywhere, but you don't know what it's going to do if it's a wild yeast. It could stop fermenting halfway through. It could do all sorts of stuff. So on a big commercial level, it's very risky to do because you wind up with a whole lot of problems. Like stop fermentation is a big issue, and sometimes you can't restart. And so we take a lot of risks by doing this, but this baby came in and it stopped at 3% residual sugar. So we have a kind of slightly sweet, not really sweet dessert wine, which by the way just won the Growers Cup for the best dessert wine in Arizona.
Wow.
And it's incredibly fragrant and complex, and you just and it's completely natural. It wasn't chaptalized. In other words, it wasn't fortified. It didn't have alcohol and sugar added, which a lot of dessert wines do. It's completely natural and a completely honest expression of where it came from.
And it tastes extremely good.
Yeah, it does.
Pretty much all Sam's wine do, which is a nice end product that they taste so good.
And that Arizona thing, I spent some time in the Page Springs winery the other day, and it seemed to be underlying much of the conversation was how much fruit comes from Arizona. And it seems that winemakers, wineries, of which we have several now, way more than people think we do, their goal is to get as much fruit from Arizona as possible.
Well, we're 100%. We have been from day one. But what's been really, really exciting for me is to go from like 10 years ago when people said, we'll drink your wine. And now they go, is this fruit all from Arizona? so the public has got a lot smarter about what's going on, which is really terrific because it matters, you know.
Well, that's it. And I want to say this too. In my experience, all the tasting rooms I've been in, some of the wine people I've talked to, they're scrupulously honest about where their grapes, where their fruit comes from, or where their wine comes from.
Well, it's not Coca-Cola. I mean, where your grapes come from is incredibly important. It's interesting. I had a situation a little while ago where someone wanted to invest money with me, and they said, well, what we want to do is we want to buy your land and then lease it back to you. And you get the money from the purchase, and then you can buy it back off of us in 10 years at a certain rate. And I said, look, you don't understand. The fact that this is my land is essential to what we're doing. This is not a stock market thing. This is actually an almost it's almost a religion, and I don't know if everyone understands that, but it's very important to me.
Well, I don't think everybody treats it that way. Go ahead, Paul.
I think you need to be completely respect the fact that when you start a process like creating a vineyard or a winery, you have to plant it. You may not have access to Arizona fruit in the beginning, and you might want to be able to sell something before that, you know, usually 6 or 7 years when you can get the plant in the ground and that first bottle to shelf.
So I plant a grapevine. How long does it take before it produces?
It's going to start producing usable fruit third and fourth year, and it's going to probably peak out at around the 6th year as far as what you know you're going to get from that vine. But the point is that you're not going to sit on your laurels and wait, and there isn't a lot of Arizona fruit that's just on the open market you could go buy. So a lot of wineries are going to have to source from other places. And people need to understand that good wine is good wine, and there's no honor lost in using fruit from somewhere else, as long as you're, you know, upfront about it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It says it on the bottle. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that we have to consider.
I didn't mean to imply that there's something wrong with people doing that. It's just something that's very
exactly.
important to me personally.
It,
and what I did was not the best economic choice. I planted my grapes basically and waited until they could produce wine when I could have brought fruit in. It's just that that's what I decided to do personally.
Right.
And if other people do other things, there's a few people, there's a few tricks that are played from time to time there's one wine where you read the label and you'd think it came from Arizona, but it doesn't. There's people not being honest. But so like Paula says, just be honest about it. That's
be honest.
Good wine is good wine, you know?
So one of the problems is there's a shortage of Arizona grapes still. There's not enough
it's
grapes.
It's kind of evening out a bit, starting to catch up. Yeah.
And we see more people planting vineyards, which is, you know, that's a process. That's a process. A lot of people could be a winemaker, but it takes a lot more money, a lot of land, a lot of time, a lot of patience, a lot of know-how to create a great vineyard. And we're still in that sort of let's see where we are and what grapes grow well. So people plant vineyards and then they decide after they make a wine, well, that one might not have worked out well, so let's graft it over to something else. So it's a process, and we're still in that process determining what grows well where, but it is evening out.
We're in the steepest learning curve ever.
I am showing up to wineries all over Arizona with my pruners, taking cuttings for my acre.
Fess up.
The worst soil in the world.
That'll make good wine, probably.
Well,
Michael,
that's what I hear. And I got my neighbor to agree, so we're going to say you, because he's just got his house on his acre and blah, whatever. I just got my house, and so there's lots of room left over for vines.
Looking at Mike's yard and stuff, it looks like a great place for a rock garden.
Guys, look at moss. Look at the top first growth vineyards in France. They're rocky soil.
Yep.
Grapevines do not like fertile soil. They produce canopy. They need to think they're going to die, and they produce seed like crazy, you know, and that's what you want to do.
I'll be done.
And
right.
Some of the vineyards there are very, very old. Is there enough land, Paula, in the Verde Valley to expand and have more vineyards here?
Yes, but the Verde Valley, if you compare the prices of the dirt to what you're maybe paying in Wilcox or that area, it can be cost prohibitive. So
that's why
it takes a lot of money up front, and you got a lot of people that are putting in small vineyards, absolutely trying to utilize their yards. And then in the hopes of maybe selling that fruit to somebody or making wine, there is room to grow. I mean, you can't plant them everywhere. It is site specific, but there is still absolutely room to grow in northern Arizona.
Well, that's it. I think the small vineyards, and they talk about adding different character to and I raised my hand when you said there are people that want, but I guess we're on radio and that nobody could see that.
It's hard for the people to see on radio.
Next time you do it, I'll tell the.
We've been doing this for 3 years, but
this is a new learning event for you. But exactly that. It's not agriculturally priced, is what I hear winemakers say. You know, it's priced for other things, for residential and for stuff like
that. How much more is the land? I mean, is it double what you paid down? When I went
through
Wilcox 20 years ago, there was almost nothing there.
Well, okay.
You know, I didn't see any vineyards
maybe I saw a couple of vineyards.
I saw your vineyards, but I didn't see much.
Well,
in
you
that
still
area.
Won't if you drive along the main roads. They're all off the beaten track, so you still wouldn't know if you cruised around, basically. But yeah, it's a lot cheaper down there. Probably the best available unplanted vineyard land right now is around 5,000 an acre.
An acre down there?
Up here would be what, like 20?
20, 25,000 an acre.
Wow. Yeah.
That's a difficulty, isn't it?
It's where do you want to live?
I have been to Wilcox, by
Wilcox
the way.
Wilcox does have some drawbacks.
Wings over.
There's no Whole Foods market in downtown Wilcox, I can tell you that.
I remember being lucky to find a diner in Wilcox.
Right. You're still lucky to find a diner in Wilcox.
I got a decent hamburger, thankfully.
Well, it plays back to what you said earlier. I mean, we have in northern Arizona, we've already created the infrastructure. So we're adding value to, we have Sedona, we've got the Grand Canyon, we've got the hotels, we've got the restaurants. That's why people are coming here. Now you add wine in as an added bonus of something to do, something to visit while you're here visiting those other established places. We're light years ahead of a lot of the, if you think about Walla Walla, which is in Washington, 30 years ago when it was just starting out in a wine industry, they didn't have any kind of a tourist industry there. So they had to create that. That's what we have kind of going for us that Wilcox doesn't really have.
Correct.
It's an agricultural farmland that's been established for years as that, but people don't tend to go visit, you know, Modesto. They go to see Napa. And those things are equal in their importance. It's just not where the general public wants to spend their time. You don't go to watch corn grow per se, and that's what you're going to maybe do in Wilcox. Up here you're going to see the beautiful red rocks, you're going to come to the film festival, whatever it is you're doing, you now have wine to add to it, which adds to the whole cultural package of why you want to come up here and why it's more expensive.
And actually, it's quite interesting, too, because everything that Paula says is correct, but what we had an interesting experience, and she was involved in the early days when Stronghold and Pillsbury Wine Company both opened tasting rooms in Old Town Cottonwood. And I'm telling you, that was 5 years ago, and 35% of the shops were shuttered.
You can't find a box to rent in Cottonwood.
It took some guts to move into Old Town.
I mean, now it's all written up in all the guidebooks, and it's like as popular as Sedona. But in those days, it took some guts because there were some interesting old places there, but there was mostly the whole area was shuttered. The little restaurants would come and go, right, Mike? And
there's something like 22 restaurants there now, I think. Is that right?
Yeah.
The old men at the coffee shop were always there, by the way.
And I
mentioned these guys once a week. We want to make sure we know who we're talking to, right? We've got a great conversation going here, but we want to make sure we got Sam Pillsbury of Pillsbury Wines. We got Paula Wosley of Revelation Wines.
Revelation Wines, Cellar Door Unhinged.
The Cellar Door Unhinged. Very good.
Cellar Door Unhinged. And you had a whole series of successful restaurants here in the...
I had a couple restaurants.
I want to tell you something. You know why I love Paula? Because about 14 years ago, I was selling my wine out of the back of my car. I met her in a parking lot outside of L'Auberge, and this blessed woman bought a couple of cases of our wine, and I've loved her ever since.
Wow. Yeah, it's support is good. Yeah.
Do you think that having a wine industry has helped the restaurants, because now I hear people saying, I'm going down to Cottonwood to have dinner for a birthday party instead of Sedona.
Yeah, you got to have dinner. Yeah, and if you've drunk enough of our wine, you don't want to drive very far either. So
it's like I said, it's all together. One-stop shop. We've got several tasting rooms, lots of great restaurants. People are coming there because it's a walking town. It's open at night. You know, on Friday and Saturday nights, there's going to be music at Burning Tree. There's going to be music at Stronghold. Those are all kind of times so that you have something to go see, something to listen to. It carries through till Sunday. You got Dave Rentz playing at the Rooster. You got something to do, and it's easy to be there. It's easy to park, and it's easy to get from place to place.
I love telling people you can park your car and you can drink as much as you like, and the only trouble you'll get into is you'll get run over crossing the road. You know,
somebody in Flagstaff was saying that the thing about Old Town area is that it is so convenient. Everything is together. Everywhere else, everything is scattered all over the place.
I want to tread lightly here, but I've heard people from here go over and say it's the un-Sedona.
It's okay, I guess. I mean, there was a
whatever
time,
that means.
Well, there was a time when Uptown Sedona was it, and you could walk around and do something there. But it seems like there's an old saying that the sidewalks roll up in Sedona at 8 o'clock at night. Well, that's different. I mean, I've had serious conversations on economic development for Sedona with some dear friends, and what do you do to create that same vibe? Well, try to imagine letting 5,000 bikers into Uptown, and right. So Cottonwood's been taken. taking risks. You know, Thunder Valley Rally and some of the things that they're doing to encourage people to come to the area is working. And, you know, that's Casey Rooney and Doug Barpach and the people that are in charge of creating that vision for Cottonwood and following through. It's been... We couldn't have done it without their help. You know, these people were out there really, really doing their jobs.
It's quite interesting. Like, in a lot of places, you get the opposite. You know, like every time you try to do anything, the town council comes up with all these regulations. I mean, they've forgotten that all that stuff is about making sure everything's okay, not stopping it from happening. And I have to say that Cottonwood has been a total exception to that. I mean, we just flew through our permitting process.
Rhythm and Ribs and Tilted Earth coming up, and lots. I guess somebody's going to talk about events here, maybe a little more specifically than I am. But they did a salsa festival for the years in Cottonwood, where part of the event was to honor a local Latino couple, or one or two.
It's a marvelous success story. We were talking to some people from Old Town who were not in the wine industry, and they said, really, it's the tasting room that came in and built up enough energy and enough people there that everything else began to happen, too. Then the restaurants could come, and then the little stores are more successful. I think there's a tea house now.
Well, everybody does the homage to Eric Jurison, and as they should, so he would say you got that backwards. The restaurants were there, then the tasting rooms.
Okay.
At least some of the restaurants.
I'm not a big expert on it.
And you're absolutely right about it. But the big shift seemed to happen after we in Stronghold.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking as one of the old men of the coffee shop, we saw the change.
Well, and also to say those restaurants are incredibly important. I mean, one of the things, Wilcox is a fantastic place to go to. It's a long drive from Phoenix, and so people need to stay the night. And there's actually quite, there's good accommodation. There's only one really decent restaurant. It's a Mexican restaurant. I have tried over the last 2 or 3 years. I bring owners of the top restaurants in Phoenix down for the weekend and treat them because I'm just hoping one of them will decide to do something really stupid and open a great restaurant down there. Because Yuppies go away for the weekend. They want to eat a nice dinner that
night. Sure, absolutely.
I think if we had one or two really more good restaurants in Wilcox, we could start making that shit.
Whatever
well.
A yuppie yeah. is, by yeah. the way.
Well, I'll include anybody who has enough money to drive 200 miles and drink wine is who I'm talking about.
The problem I think that Sedona has, and working in the tourist industry for many, many years, one of the biggest complaints was that they roll up the sidewalks. And people say, well, how late can I go to dinner here? And I'd say, well, 8 o'clock, but they say, you can't go to dinner at 10? I wouldn't try that here in Sedona. So there is that reputation of rolling up the sidewalks I think they're working on projects, but it's hard to get to one from place to another.
It's much more spread out,
And I think that's the challenges that Sedona face.
Well, the thing is also about Old Town, the lovely thing about it is pretty much unchanged since the 1800s. And in those days, people did walk a lot more. So it's more like a European city in that sense, mm-hmm. where it's like a walking village, And it's interesting, like in particularly in the UK, you go to Oxford or any one of those little old villages, and the main street is the same, and around the back is all the parking, and that's what Bartosz and co have done in Cottonwood. You can park your car on the back, but the main street is on the
That's absolutely the best way to do it. It seems too late to do that. I know in Sedona they've talked about it, but it seems too late. So Paula, why don't you tell us about what you're up to for a bit? What is your new winery? It's going to be in Old Town, a little bit off of Main Street. Right?
It's going to be on the corner of Pima and First. It's called Revelation Wines. It's in an old church.
That's hence the basically name. The theme. We have to spell things out here.
Yeah, hence the name. We've got two wines out currently, and they are both California fruit, so that's why I stood up for that. The Chardonnay is called Our Lady of Questionable Decisions.
Is that based on you, Paul?
Yeah. And I spend a lot of my time these days working with the college. I work at Yavapai College for the Viticulture and Enology program. This semester I'm teaching.
One of the few in the country, by the way, with the...
One of three junior colleges in the country that has a actual working winery on the campus. We grow the grapes. We are up to 17 acres of fruit planted there now. We're in our sixth year. We are starting to see people coming from afar to go to school.
All ages.
all ages. From, I mean, we've had people come from Napa. We've had people come from other states. Phoenix. I've got students in Phoenix. Sam, be happy to know I'm teaching New Zealand and Australia this semester. So it's going to hit Sam up to maybe come and talk to my class about New Zealand.
I tell you what you should do. I'm flying to New Zealand on the 10th, on the 8th of March. And give me a call when I'm there and we'll talk about.
Oh, that'd be fun.
You can talk all the way from New Zealand.
Where they call Shiraz, Shiraz.
Yeah. That's true.
That's right.
But New Zealand makes good wine. Name, so.
No, it's a long. We're not going to go into that. But aside from Yavapai College, right now we are planning. The Verde Valley Wine Consortium is gearing up for our fourth annual symposium, which will take place at Yavapai College on May 30th.
How much? Remember?
Well, it's going to be two separate tickets. One for a tasting that's going to be going all day, and if you want to do that, it's going to be like $30. Okay. And then there is a. Educational component with guest speakers and industry specialists. We're taking, our theme this year is taking root. And so we have another ticket price, like $60. And we have early bird tickets going on sale March 15th. So they'll be a little less than that. So if you want to do the whole day and do the, you know, speakers and then go out and drink wine and go see some food vendors and come back in and hear more speakers, that's how that's going to be set up.
Tell us the date again and what it's called.
May 30th. And it's the fourth annual Verde Valley Wine Symposium put on by the Verde Valley Wine Consortium and Yavapai College.
Tom, you got to get us on TV. These look she's giving
Yavapai
me.
It's going to be at Yavapai College. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
And can they call the college to?
No, don't call the college.
Don't call the college.
You're going to want to go to verdevalleywine.org for more information on tickets, which are not going to go on sale for a couple more weeks. But by the time we get March 15th rolling, go there. You'll be able to get it. And we'll see some ads and advertising will start this month. We've also got coming up the Camp Verde Heritage Pecan and Wine Festival, which is March 28th and 29th in Camp Verde. It's a two-day affair that is pecans and car show and archaeology center and a huge wine tasting. We've got 14 wineries coming up for that one. That's going to be great. And then you have Tilted Earth, which is, I think, the 25th and the 26th of June.
Oh, I can look for you.
And that's another two-day affair. That's going to be in Cottonwood.
19th and 20th.
19th and 20th. Okay, sorry. Excuse me. Riverfront Park. That one's going to be another big winery. There's lots of people, music, fun for everybody, stuff for the kids to do. So, you know, weather gets nice. You start seeing wine events and all kinds of things coming up on the horizon. Right now I'm focusing on the film festival. So we've got three wineries that have graciously supported the film festival. I've been securing wine for Pat Schweiss for 21 years for this event. So we did it again this year, and I want to thank Pillsbury, who did it a couple years ago.
If you
but
asked
I didn't
me,
eat him up this year.
You didn't know.
Next year I'll get
I'm
you.
I'm hurt.
Don't be hurt. We have Chateau Tumbleweed, who supported him this year, and Dancing Apache. These are a couple of newer wineries. Yes. And then Caduceus again. So I want to thank those people for helping us with the film festival. I've actually got my VIP badge on, and I'm going to hit a movie after this.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Very efficient. She's come up with extra reasons. You got to do the show this morning and go to the film festival.
I planned it that way. I looked at the, what am I going to be doing at 9 o'clock on Monday morning? Ah, oh, perfect time to go to a movie.
So. Are the classes at Yavapai pretty complete? If I wanted to learn how to plant a vineyard and make a wine.
Yes, they are complete. You can get a certificate, a one-year certificate, or a two-year associate's degree in viticulture and enology, or both. So if you spend 2 years there, you'd be pretty well ahead of the curve when it comes to wanting to work in a local winery or even going somewhere outside of the Verde Valley. I mean, that's the whole point. We can teach you how to make wine, which hasn't really changed in thousands of years. We can teach you the new technology, and we could also teach you how to grow grapes in an arid environment, which is a little bit different than what you might see happening at Davis or some other college that teaches viticulture.
What grapes grow well in the Verde Valley, for example?
We're still figuring it out. I mean, Cabernet, Syrah, people are doing some great things with Tempranillo and Nebbiolo. We see Zinfandel at a couple places. I think we're leaning more towards French varietals. French and Italian varietals seem to be where it's at. Malvasia is a Italian varietal that we see being planted. It's a white grape, very aromatic. That's doing fairly well. And then the college is experimenting with a lot of different fruit. So we'll know more in a few more years.
Sam, what about in Wilcox? What What works in Arizona?
It's very site specific for a bunch of reasons. Generally speaking, the Mediterranean varieties do best. There's an assumption that we're a very warm climate for grape growing. We're not. We're high altitude, so it's actually quite cool. What we are is very sunny. And because of the way the temperature drops at night and in the high altitude, like around 40 degrees diurnal temperature swing, the overall temperatures are actually quite moderate. The only wine grape that I don't think really excels where we are is Pinot Noir, which is possibly Riesling, which are really cooler climate varieties. But there's other things that work and don't work, mostly the Mediterranean varieties, so Italian, Spanish, and French. I'm almost totally Rhone, Southern Rhone varieties, because that's my preference in terms of wine. But weirdly, Pinot Gris from there is from our vineyard is fabulous. Chardonnay is mind-blowingly good. Cab Sav grows really well. I'm not interested in Cab myself personally. What seems to suit the area best, in my opinion, is Syrah and Petit Syrah, I think, probably. But the Chardonnay that's why I'm down there. I tasted a 97 Chard in 1999 that was grown down there. It was so extraordinary. I drove down the next day and bought 40 acres next door to this guy. I went into business with him. Actually, it was quite funny. In those days, it was $400 an acre. And I remember that in 2000, I planted 20 acres with this guy. And one of the jokes on Saturday Night Live was one of the 10 best ways to lose money was to plant a vineyard in Arizona. And I thought, yes, that's why I only paid $400 an acre for my land, you know. So
how did you learn to make wine?
Make movies. I just worked alongside. I didn't go to school for those things. I have a master's degree in English literature. I taught Shakespeare at Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. But I worked with some other people for a couple of years, and then I did the same thing with wine. Yeah.
And Paula, you taught yourself too, basically.
I don't make wine. I'd like to drink wine. I sell wine. I'm out there selling and talking about wine and sitting on panels and boards and encouraging the industry to grow. And you know, I want to be here. So I live here, and this is something I love to do. So I do it.
And what about Revelation Winery? You have got two wines.
We do have two wines.
You don't do the making. You're not the wine.
You're
like owner.
We have defined. We have a winemaker. We have somebody who does marketing. We have somebody who does the back of the house and the licensing and the books. And I'm out front selling.
Wow. It takes a lot of specialties to do this, I take it. You know.
Marketing's a really big thing. I remember before I actually started, as I was starting planting, I remember reading this article from some Australian wine person. I can't remember who it was, but he was saying, you know, all these guys, all you guys that want to go out there and make wine, guess what, folks? You got to sell this stuff, you know. So,
right.
So, and you know, I got to tell you, you know, a decade ago, no one was going to walk into a restaurant in Arizona and ask for a bottle of Pillsbury wine, you know. So you got to go out there and work your butt off.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot. Convincing somebody to try something new.
And you're trying to convince them to try Arizona wine.
Well, we are. And you'd be amazed at how many people don't realize that there's an Arizona wine industry that live in Arizona.
Who are in the food and restaurant business.
Right. Yeah.
I'm telling you, it's absolutely extraordinary.
You know, I have a friend who's in the working for Oregon wineries. And it's even hard for Oregon wineries out in the greater states to produce or to sell wine. It's just difficult. People don't even realize Oregon, and they're ahead of us by 40 years.
Absolutely.
So at this point, it's about educating our own people and then try to get out there in the world.
I get wine people who've been drinking wine for decades who will sneer at you as you're pouring your wines and laugh to their friends about how actually it's quite funny. I got to tell you, I lived in California for 20 years making movies, and I lived in New Zealand for a long time. And in both those places, people who make wine there now say to me, "What the hell are you doing growing wine grapes in Arizona?" And I think, boy, you got really short memories. That's what people were saying about you guys 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Doesn't take people long to become conservatives, does it, Michael Cosentino?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. That's a great story, and that's true. Sneering at Arizona wines was a pastime for lots of folks that drank wine.
Well, they sneered at Santa Barbara County wines.
Everywhere.
Young.
Oh, yeah, you absolutely.
Know, they thought, you know, why aren't you up north? What are you doing? And now there's...
Listen, nobody knows what will happen when you plant a classical grape variety in a new location. There are some rules, like too hot or too humid, which you need to look around at. But you know what? You never know.
boy, it's just
well, that's it. These regions, Chile, I mean, and Argentina, some of these places that just grow great, and Australia grow great wines. Or grow great grapes and make great wines. Nobody would have thought, and so Arizona is definitely one of those places. And we probably never will. And Sam and Paula could talk about soil, and we can talk about techniques and all those things, but don't necessarily want to do that. I am drawn to the Petit Syrahs and the Syrahs, and the Rhones and the Rosos and all that. That seems to be, but, you know, I spend my time combing the tasting rooms in Arizona looking for that Chateau Neuf de Pop for about half the price. But so far I'm getting close. I'm moving in on that. But these blends that some of you guys are making are just if taste matters, which, you know, in the wine world, I'm not sure it does. I'm just a working slob here, so, you know, I'm not, you know, a $135 bottle of wine or a $21 bottle of wine.
More slob than working, maybe. Well,
Michael, two of my favorite reds that we make are the Rhone Red and the Diva, which are basically a Cote de Rhone and a Chateau Neuf. So have a look at those.
I will.
I should say Mike is a very respectable looking person.
Well, thank you. Yeah, especially, yeah, I'm trying the new look here. Does it make my face look big?
I don't know about this acre of rocks you're planting vines on. Paula, what does he have?
Rocks are good. I mean, you keep talking about Chateau Neuf de Pops. They have rocks that are the size of your head strewn about the vineyard.
There you go.
Old river beds and rocks, if you can imagine, are very helpful in that they'll keep the heat in during the night. They allow the like Sam says, these plants want to struggle. They want to find water. They got to dig their roots and get seriously involved with the minerals and the things that are under the rocks looking for water.
That stops erosion. It increases minerality.
Yeah, I mean, low water crop usage here, this is great for us. We have an amazing soil diversity in Arizona. As you can look around, you've got volcanic, you've got alluvial, you've got riverbeds, you've got granite, you've got limestone. People hate caliche. We like caliche. It's a great thing. It's full of limestone. That's one of the greatest things as far as minerality goes for grapes
Our whole 100 acres has got caliche at 3 to 4 feet.
Correct. Yep. And that's like growing on limestone and, you know, talk Bordeaux. I mean, that's an amazing thing to have here. So we appreciate that. And it's okay that we don't get as much rain. We have enough rain. I mean, our issues here are going to be too hot, too cold. Right now we have that potential for vines to be flowering early this year because of our weather we've had. And we don't want to see that happen because we know, we live here, what happens when the flowers come out too early, then it comes along April.
April,
bam,
storm, bam.
Freeze, lose the flowers, now you have a short crop. So, I mean, it is a challenge for sure, but this is a great place to be doing it.
It is just like fruit. We watched those blooms come early and then panic. Which is kind of what's going on right now, at least in some cases. Since we're playing Chamber of Commerce this morning and taking a little break from politics, the name of the show is Democratic Perspective, and we talk about politics a lot. But every once in a while, we do a show like this, and we're talking about two great industry, wine industry people here, Sam Pillsbury and Paula Wosley. We have
I've heard complaints you don't do enough politics.
She just showed me.
I'll do politics anytime you want.
Okay.
All right. That's right. Sam and I are good Facebook friends. Speaking of Facebook, Paula just showed me that Diane Jones and Doug Bartosz are in Tempe collecting an award for Cottonwood as the town of the decade. I'm not sure exactly how they determine that. It's some sort of economic thing, I believe.
And it takes place over a decade, apparently.
Sustainable Economic Growth City of the Decade Award.
Wow. There you go. All right. Good on you, Cottonwood.
So, Paula, when you're trying to, Apple used to call them
evangelist. We have
evangelist.
A wine called that.
So you're sort of a wine evangelist, right?
That's fair enough.
Promoting your wines, but you're also promoting all Arizona wines.
I am actually a member of the Society of Wine Educators and was asked to speak this year, coming in August, at their annual conference in New Orleans. In August, which of course is not probably the greatest time to be in New Orleans. It's also pretty difficult to pull together winemakers who might want to come with me.
You get a cheap
but I've been asked to put on a presentation in front of several hundred people about Arizona. And that's pretty amazing because the Society of Wine Educators is industry people, you know, master sommeliers, importers, all kinds of geeky wine people. And we're to the point now where, yeah, we might want to hear a little something about Arizona. I mean, I've been a member since 1999. Nobody's asked me to do a presentation before. So I'm putting together a presentation about Arizona, about the three separate regions. We'll have examples of wines from those regions. It's not about just talking about my winery or just Northern Arizona winery. It's about bringing up the whole state. And I think that I'm pretty good at doing that. You know, fairly and not taking favoritism or trying to push one region over the other. And we're going to have a pretty good showing there, and I'm excited to do it.
And it takes years. I mean, you look at France, you look at these other places I mentioned. We're talking, you know, we've been around for a generation, maybe, the gentleman that started down south. Who is at one of the Yavapai College wine consortiums. And Sam's going to tell me his name.
Gordon Dutt.
Gordon Dutt.
Right. We're talking 60s. We're talking just a generation. So the wine industry may be a generation into it. To get the kind of recognition is going to be, we'll all be gone, and our grandchildren maybe will be talking about wondering why Arizona wines were ever not as on par with California or France or whatever.
So we have Sam who needs to promote his own winery because you need to sell wine to have a winery, right? And we have Paul who's promoting all Arizona wine. What is the biggest problem that you face in getting out the word about your wines, about Arizona wines?
I would say two things. One of them is a kind of entrenched bigotry. I can tell you, 14 years ago, it took me a year to get a wine into a restaurant. Now only half of the restaurants I go into don't know there's any such thing as an Arizona wine, which I have to say completely floors me. I'm from New Zealand, and in 1997, I knew more about Arizona wine than a lot of Phoenix restaurateurs do right now. I think the other thing is just at the moment our wines are a little more expensive than others because we're starting out from scratch and we're gradually bringing our prices down as our vines get older and our costs of production come down. But that you know, people in restaurants will say your wines are too expensive, and actually they're not, because they're very high quality wines. Eric Glomsky and I in France a couple of years ago compared our wines with some equal grapes, French wines, and the 160 people we poured for said that our wines were as good as, if not better than, the French wines we compared them to, and they were a third the price. So actually, our wines are cheap. But we can't make $5 a bottle wines in this state. That's just not possible.
Can't do it. There's no infrastructure to support the industry yet. So every single barrel, every single plant, all the chemicals, all the posts, everything you need to do to make it have to come from somewhere else. They have to be shipped in, which adds costs. And then, you know, it's all startup. So eventually, we'll be at a point where we can charge less, and that's going to be.
But believe me, as a customer of, and since the beginning, the prices have come down a lot. I mean, just you couldn't, you had, you're going to spend $30-$40 at least on a bottle of Arizona wine. Now you can buy in a restaurant a bottle of Arizona wine, you know, $22-$25, which is amazing as far as, and I believe they're selling more. I got to say this. You couldn't find it. You can find Arizona wine in the supermarket. You can find Arizona wine in a restaurant. You can find Arizona wine at the Verde Lee Market, for God's sakes. You know, a little neighborhood grocery store. So that is, at least from a consumer standpoint, I'm looking at their coming of age. In other words, the Verde Valley is certainly making its mark in a big way on the wine industry.
We want to salute these folks for doing something new and different.
And coming to the studio early in the morning,
yeah,
in spite of the directions that somebody might give them.
And you know, we're always into supporting people who do something local, do something new, who take chances, who don't just take a franchise from somewhere, but start from ground up. We know how hard it is. I worked in the restaurant industry years ago. So we want to salute you for that. We want to thank our couple of our donors, Democrats of the Red Rocks.
Yes.
And Democrats of the Verde Valley for their support and for all the listeners.
These people help keep us on the air, and we're grateful for that.
So this podcast, and I don't know quite where we are on time, Tom, this podcast and all our other podcasts will be available on VVID.org.
Yes.
And next week we have Terry Goddard.
Terry Goddard. Talking
about
dark money.
Dark money next week.
Big, big topic in Arizona. Thanks, folks.
Been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.